My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
The Lifestyle Show. Presented by Anna Glavinsky.
Now, so many of us were impacted by the pandemic, by COVID. In many different ways, it might have affected your job, it might have affected your loved ones, it might have indeed affected your own health. Now, we're speaking to somebody, two people actually, who are talking about their experience with COVID, which not only impacted one person's health, but also the family group around them. So Jen and Steph, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. We've got a broad topic to cover, and it sounds like it's very vulnerable, and you're going to be sharing both your experiences. So thank you for joining me. How are you today?
Yeah, we're good. Thank you.
Yeah. Now, who would like to go first in just first of all, telling us what the book's about and why you decided to write it?
Yeah. So it's quite a lengthy story. Obviously, the pandemic hit us quite hard. I decided to write the book because I had some post-traumatic stress from the whole experience, because I was in intensive care for 7 weeks. I had a lot of delirium whilst I was coming out of the coma, and I decided to write it to kind of help me come to terms with that. And then whilst I was asleep, Mum had kept a diary, which was really useful for me because I don't remember very much of what actually happened. And it just fitted really well with my sort of experiences, which were very random, whereas Mum was very much exactly what happened. So we put it together into a book, and I think it's helped both of us with sort of initiating conversation and with just generally dealing with the trauma, because it was quite a dramatic reaction that we had.
Well, I think it's really interesting the way that you decided to go about it with both of your points of view, because it's so easy just to focus, I say just in inverted commas here, I think you know what I mean, but just to focus singularly on the symptoms and, you know, that impact of COVID itself. But it had a much further reaching impact, and it wasn't just the one person who was affected by it. Steph, could you just tell us a little bit about it from your point of view?
My point of view.
You know, it changed your life as well.
It certainly did, yes. Jen went downhill very quickly, and it was quite traumatic getting her into hospital. And once she got into hospital, we sort of slowly lost touch. At first she was able to text me, and then gradually the text began to dwindle, and I was getting difficult phone calls from her, and then it all stopped. So it was difficult for me to know exactly what was happening. I was contacting the hospital regularly, but they were so busy, and it was really hard. Speaking to the same person each time was not an option. So it was a very difficult time. I felt very alone at that point. But I decided to keep the diary because so many people were phoning and texting and messaging and WhatsApping and everything, emailing. I couldn't keep on top of it as well, remembering what I was being told at the hospital. So I kept a diary, and it was very useful, and it's something I'd recommend to others who have someone in intensive care.
It's a point of view that I actually have never considered before. Well, you know, the fantastic news is that you're both out the other side of it. Let's go back to the very, very beginning, before you knew how bad it was going to get. Jen, when did you know that you had contracted COVID? And when did you realise, uh-oh, this is actually going to be bad for me?
So I think I was probably in denial about that for quite a while. But I tested positive just randomly, actually. I didn't have any symptoms at all. But I worked in a nursery, a baby tested positive, and in line with the plan that we put together, all of the staff got tested as well, just to see. And I didn't really expect my test to come back positive. So it was a bit of a surprise, given that I felt fine. Honestly, I don't remember a massive amount after testing positive. Wow. I think the next day I started to become unwell. I tried to carry on working from home, but I couldn't. And all I know is that on day seven, I was taken by ambulance to hospital. But then I was sent home. So I refused to go back until day 14 when I was really sick. But I really don't remember most of that time. So a lot of those memories have come from Mum. And I think that's why her diary was so important, because I don't remember the things that actually happened. I only remember what happened in my head.
Do you think in a way you felt a bit protected? You know, that was your body's defence mechanism looking after you going through this really horrible time. And actually, obviously, so. You felt the physical impact of it, but your mum, Steph, was, you know, watching it and feeling the emotional impact.
Those 2 weeks were very difficult. When I brought her home from hospital the first time, I was very reluctant to bring her home, but they were so busy and they had decided to discharge her, and you think they know best. They were incredibly busy on that day. There was a big queue outside A&E and everything. So, but she's very stubborn, and all through I could see her going downhill and downhill. By the second week, she was really, really ill, but she was still refusing to let me ring 999 or 111 until that last Sunday when she finally gave in. And even then she didn't want me to ring 111. She tried to get me. She said, oh, no, don't worry about it. I'll email them instead. Don't you worry about it. But I did ring 111 and they took her in pretty much straight away then. And then we gradually lost touch, didn't we? Yes. Yeah.
And Jen, do you feel like that sort of adamant refusal to face what was going on was because you just couldn't believe it would be happening to you? Or were you worried about, you know, the weight of everything going on the emergency services as well? Like a guilt, you know?
I think I felt like, well, they sent me home, so therefore I must be fine, and I don't really want to go back and bother them again because they thought I was okay. And I suppose the whole burden thing was, even in my unconscious dreams that I had, I was always a burden throughout the whole thing. So it's funny how it sort of works in your own mind, how things that you're actually thinking kind of project onto the things that you dream. And those dreams are the things that I remember the most vividly.
It's quite fascinating, this concept of memory, because there was a lot of time that went by, 7 weeks. Did you have time to feel scared? Can you remember looking back? And what did that length of time actually feel like as well? Did it feel like 7 weeks?
Not
she was asleep.
No, I was
she
asleep.
Was asleep for 7 weeks.
I was asleep for 7 weeks, but the 2 weeks before that, I don't remember, and probably a couple of weeks after. So it's quite a big period of time that I can't remember. And I've got the odd flashes of memory, but nothing specific. During that time, so it is a bit strange.
Was it almost like a surprise to you when you started getting your consciousness back, how long you'd been under for?
Yeah, it was a real surprise, and I missed Christmas, so I'm really very upset about that. I woke up in January and Christmas had already been and gone, so it was really strange.
You really couldn't believe it, could you?
No.
But
you asked me if I felt scared, and I think the main time that I felt scared actually was when I woke up And I started to realize that actually I couldn't move either of my arms and I couldn't move either of my legs. And I was actually stuck in this bed. And oh my goodness, how am I going to come back from this?
Wow.
I can remember that thought quite vividly of, wow, I've got a whole mountain. I don't know how I'm going to come back from it.
My goodness.
So that was, yeah.
She couldn't speak or anything. She was just communicating with her eyes. I mean, I wasn't there, obviously, but at the start, she was just communicating with her eyes. So it must have been extremely scary.
It must have been a sense of panic.
With all the delirium dreams going around in her head as well. So.
Yeah, that does sound extremely frightening. Talk us through that recovery process then, because, you know, physically the worst time of it obviously is when you're in a coma, but then emotionally and consciously probably the hardest time would have been that road to recovery. How did that go?
Absolutely. It felt very long. I was in hospital for about 4 months, I think, and then I spent 2 months in a rehabilitation place. It felt very long, particularly as I started to become a little bit more aware of what was going on, aware of what was around me. And I didn't really understand that I couldn't stand up for quite a long time afterwards until they took me into the physio room and said, right, let's stand up. And I couldn't, even with four people trying to pull me up, I couldn't. My muscles were just so weak, I couldn't do anything. So it was long. It was long.
And were you motivated to feel that there was a road to recovery?
I am pretty stubborn. So, yes, I always believed that there would be. But at times, it was very, very difficult to see how on earth that was going to happen. So I'm a wheelchair user now. So it was very difficult to see how people actually manage when they're using a wheelchair. And there was very little information on how I was going to possibly do that. So it was a tricky time, but I am very stubborn and I was pretty determined that I was going to get some function back. And I suppose luckily I got back the majority of my brain function, which is the most important thing for me anyway, that I'm still able to do those things, to talk to you and things like that. Unfortunately, I lost my singing voice, which you might be able to hear, but I had a tracheostomy. And obviously my lungs are quite damaged. So the singing voice that I cherished beforehand never came back, despite I've had quite a lot of speech therapy, but that didn't come back. But otherwise, I think brain-wise, I'm okay.
Yeah, just managing to work as well. So, we didn't know if she was going to come back to us as a vegetable, to be perfectly honest, because when they took her off the ventilator, she was a long time before she came round.
It was a week, wasn't it?
Yes, so and they were really unsure. In fact, on Christmas Eve, the doctor rung me and asked me to put in a DNR in place because they said she wasn't strong enough to withstand resuscitation, and they didn't know how she was going to be affected because they discovered she'd had a stroke during her time while she was ventilated. So she'd had pneumonia, sepsis, a stroke,
organ failure,
internal bleeding. So she really wasn't expected to get through. So that was all very difficult.
And I can remember being visited quite a lot afterwards by different doctors going, you're a miracle. Yes. I can't quite believe that I'm talking to you. And for me, it was really strange because I didn't remember that really bad stuff. So it all felt a little bit surreal and a little bit odd.
Well, like you say, there's two very different points of view there from the two of you, you know, the one living it and then also the one watching it. Steph, I imagine that you would have wanted to try and inform yourself as much as you could about what was going on. It was a very, very new disease. Did you just put yourselves in the hands of the doctors? Did you get any support from other parents or people going through the same thing? Where were you able to get information from? How did you cope with that?
I think a lot of the difference, sorry for interrupting, is that I contracted it in November 2021. So actually, there was already 18 months or so where people knew what COVID was, and a lot of people had gone through intensive care. So I think if the doctors hadn't got that sort of 18 months behind them, that I probably wouldn't have survived, because they knew what to do with me.
Yeah, they did actually say that if she'd contracted it earlier, she wouldn't have got through it, even though she'd had three vaccinations. She wouldn't have got through it. So they did know more about COVID by then. The vaccinations were going, and, you know, we did know more. But as for knowing what was going on, that was really quite difficult, because I couldn't visit, obviously. And it was difficult to speak to someone to find out what was going on. I did ring nearly every day. They told me I could ring every day. She had a 24-hour nurse with her. But obviously it wasn't always the same nurse. So sometimes I got conflicting information. And to actually talk to a doctor wasn't that easy. We did have a telephone appointment with a doctor at one point. My son came over to take it with me, because we had millions of questions, obviously. So that was useful. But other than that, the only thing I had was the phone calls from phoning in to see how she was, and sometimes conflicting phone calls when on the day that we put the DNR in place, the next day I had a phone call from a physio and a doctor, both us saying they were going to work with her and everything, and that she was, you know, that they wanted to know more about her. So I thought, oh, she's all right. And then that evening, the other doctor who put the DNR in place said, oh, no, she's not out of the woods. She needs the DNR, definitely. That's, you know, so I was getting conflicting information some of the time, which was understandable, because they were still very busy.
And, well, I mean, it's been a very, very heartfelt chat, and it's a crazy experience. And then my next question, it's okay if the answer is no, but I am curious, looking back on it now, is there any positives that you've been able to take from it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yes. I think so. I think the importance of family, the importance of life generally. I think I've certainly come out a very different person, very much more positive. Strangely, I'm eating food that I would never eat before, but I don't know why that is.
Much more confident now, aren't you, than you were? It was really difficult at first. It's taken a long time to get to where we are. But yes, I think there's definitely positive, and that's what we were hoping to bring over in the book as well, that there is a positive side to it.
I think the hope, the support and the love of the family and the incredible, extraordinary intensive care staff who really did save my life. And 2 weeks ago, I went back and to intensive care, actually, and met some of them, which was a great experience for me and for them, because I don't think they often get to see people sort of on the other side.
Yeah.
Lovely. They did remember Jen, don't know. I think she's quite famous. I think that everybody remembers her there. But
it was Rick, because it was so touching.
So they also said that talking to us is helping them, because they're trying to set up some system that is going to help people that have been through intensive care.
Follow-up service. It's a very intense environment, and it's a very unusual experience. And you know, because of the delirium that I suffered, a lot of the things that I remember didn't happen, but in my head they happened. Mm. So I thought that I remember someone telling me that I'd rung the police. I didn't ring the police, but in my head, it feels like I did.
Wow, that's strange.
You know, they're sorting out a follow-up system so that people can be helped to overcome things like that. And you know, they've certainly been really good with me.
That's a really good outlook, isn't it? Because it's not just about saving the life, it's about making sure that you have quality of life thereafter. So that's really great.
Absolutely.
Right, we're going to have to wrap it up there. The title of the book is called Can You Tell Me Where You Are? Could you just tell us why you came up with that title, and then we'll be ending the interview?
It just sort of hit me one day. I was trying to think of a title, and that is just something that they ask you every single day, and possibly more than once a day, I don't know. But I can remember not getting it right at all, but then realizing the day that I left intensive care, that fist pump moment when I did get it right, and I kind of knew, yeah, I think I do know where I am.
Wow.
But up until that point, I had literally no idea. I was off having, you know, different experiences. So that's where it came from.
Fantastic. Mm. Thank you. Well, I mean, what a journey. What a crazy experience. Thank you so much for sharing it with us, and also for putting pen to paper and turning it into a book. The book is called Can You Tell Me Where You Are? It's by Jen Higgs and also by her mum, Steph Higgs. You can find it on Amazon or the Talk Radio Europe bookshop. Jen, Steph, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk.
Crazy weather we're having.
No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer. First 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.